Buck's Pocket to the shores of Orange Beach and all points in between. An insider's perspective on Alabama politics. It's the Jeff Poor Show.
I don't think Hank done it this way.
Welcome back to the Jeff Poor Show on FM Talk 106.5. Probably wondering, who is this on my radio airwaves right now? It's Jeff Poor. Starting a show today. Today is the first day. Thank you for listening. Coming up on the program in a little bit, State Representative Matt Simpson. He'll be with us in studio. I talked to him about the prisons and other things, state issues, but I'm going to make him a regular feature. Looking forward to that. Hopefully you can stay tuned. This new show, part of live and local, 8 hours a day continuously from 6 a.m. till 2 p.m. So going to make the most of it. Organically produced, as Sean Sullivan has said. So really excited about what the future has in store. Want to hear from you, 251-343-0106. You hit us up on the text line or however you see fit. You also hit me up on Twitter, twitter.com/Jeff_Poor. Let us know anything you got on your mind, and we'll talk about it. Something else I wanted to bring up. What I do on my weekends, there's a show that comes on Alabama Public Television called Capital Journal. It's kind of a public affairs program. Don Daly, very good host, and they bring in the newsmakers of the day. One of the guests on this week, Gwendolyn Goodvin of Birmingham. She's a state representative there. She has an idea. This is something you may have not thought, well, this could never, you know, this is not something we would do in Alabama. But she wants to, she has a bill put forward. It's pre-filed. I believe she's got Anthony Daniels, the minority leader in the House, Democrat, is a co-sponsor on it. And they want to teach the synopsis of the bill. I'll just read it for you here. It says, quote, "This bill would require public K-12 schools to include in their curriculum a semester-long course in Black American history. This bill would also require the state of education to adopt rules for its implementation and enforcement." Other than the state of Alabama, and we've had all these discussions about our education system being commandeered from the top down, but I think it's a noble idea. But she did this interview on Friday night. It ran on that Friday night, talking about, you know, what had happened in America in 1619 and Jamestown, and why is that 1619 so important? And the 1619 project is something that when you hear that, would it ever be possible that in Alabama schools we would teach this, the 1619 project, which was a project of the New York Times Magazine? And the idea is the country wasn't founded in 1776, but really 1619, when slaves first came to the shores of the United States and started, or what would be the United States, and started building the country. And this is all kinds of critics. There's a movement afoot in the Congress to keep this from being any part of the education curriculum, that if you teach this, federal dollars will be withheld for your education, for your state, for your locality, or however those dollars are dispersed. But it's interesting that, you know, you would never think Alabama, but there is a push. The 1619 project could come to Alabama, and that, you know, it's a very radical notion that it could be, you know, taught in our schools. But it is at least there on the radar, and it's something being discussed. But I know it's very controversial. I wanted to mention that. And the way we teach history in this country is now, now the time you're going to see a lot of these, you're going to see a lot of people pushing for things of this nature. So that's something to keep on your radar. The strike while the iron's hot, as they say. It looks like we had a phone call. Let's hear from Gary. Let's talk about Trump. Gary, what's on your mind?
Yeah, good morning. Welcome to your new show, Jeff. Wish you all the success in the world.
Hey, Gary, thanks for that.
Hey, you made comment earlier about Donald Trump that I don't agree with, and you kind of said you were making the point that when you get past a lot of the rhetoric, he's pretty much just another U.S. president, and I don't, or maybe you meant another U.S. Republican president, but
right? That's
way,
that's what I meant. Another, you know, not that far out of the mainstream,
right? And I think. I know I, like, for instance, I vote for him because of his policies, not because of his ego or his personality or persona or whatever. But I think he is different in a number of ways. One, obviously, he didn't come out of the political network. Secondly, one of the first things he did, and I know people that work in D.C. and you know, when he made the decree that we want to eliminate we want to eliminate two regulations for every new one we create, that was a significant change in the culture of regulatory activity. And that was a change. The wall is another big change in that he, you know, and I get frustrated because I don't think he articulates it very well, but because I think if we could get a good, secure border, then he and a lot of other Republicans would be receptive to maybe adjusting the threshold for legal immigrants. And I think if he could frame that better, he could get more support for what he's trying to do. And there's a number of other things he's doing that to me is somewhat non-traditional. And I think that's why the people that support his policies really like him. And the people that are wanting bigger government and more social programs and so forth can't stand the guy, and his tweets and stuff just makes it even easier to dislike him if you do.
Hey, Gary, thank you for the call. I'll just add to this what I think is really the appeal of Donald Trump. I mean, there is some policy appeal to it. But people voted for Trump because it was just something different. Do you ever get the sense that we have all these round holes in Washington, D.C., and the American people just kind of fed up with the system, and they sent a square peg to Washington, D.C. to disrupt it? Because Washington, D.C., let's take it beyond Washington, D.C. Let's say if you took somebody from 2015, for example, right? And you put them down in 2020 America, is it really that different? Has the country changed, aside from COVID-19, which is not of Donald Trump's making, but our institutions and everything kind of is similar in some ways. Government, if anything, has become more of a presence in our life than less of a presence, and that's not, you know, that's not typical of a Republican administration. But when I say wholesale changes, I mean, like, I'm talking like FDR kind of stuff here. Going from Calvin Coolidge to FDR in the span of a decade, that kind of stuff. Getting through the Great Depression. The country, for the most part, from Obama to Trump, a lot of the institutions run similarly. They're a lot alike in that way. So when I say that, I don't think Donald Trump came in and set out to radically overhaul the country. I don't think you had the idea of like a Ron Paul, what he would do to the country, which would be really radical. You know, shut down the Department of Education, do away with a lot of these bureaucracies, streamline some things or do things that we don't even think government ought to be in the business of. And taking that and making that... So a part of it, because that's what I say. When I say Donald Trump's not much different than any other American president, I mean, I don't mean that he hasn't done different things. Obviously, every president is distinct and will have their own legacy, but he's not that far out of the mainstream, and particularly with the Republican Party. What he talks about, I think he has put more of a focus on domestic policy, you know, labor, borders, all of that, but he hasn't really remade the country, not like we were told he would if he were elected. All right, guys, we got to take a break. We will return. This is FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Pancho met his match, you know, on the deserts down in Mexico. Nobody heard his dying word.
Cotton on the roadside, cotton in the ditch. We all picked the cotton, but we never got rich. Daddy was a veteran, a Southern Democrat. They ought to get a rich man to vote like that. Sing it.
And welcome back to FM Talk 106.5. This is the debut of the Jeff Poor show. Still to come on the program in the next segment, State Representative Matt Simpson. He's in the bullpen warming up right now, loosening up, getting ready for these hardball interviews he has to face here on these airwaves. So you want to stay tuned for that. Coming up tomorrow on the program, give you a little tease of that. Al Bakari of Breitbart News, my colleague at Breitbart News, also right at Breitbart. But he'll join us. We're going to talk to him about the big tech, way it's kind of taking over our politics. Is it as big of a threat? I tend to think that threat's overplayed, but I do think big tech has some monopoly issues, and they like to tinker with things in a way that's very unsavory, and it needs to be addressed. I'm not quite sure how you do that, but we'll get into that with somebody with far more expertise than I have with Alan Bakari. Also on the program, Dan Gaynor, my first boss in Washington, D.C. with the Media Research Center, will be with us, talk about the media, and then probably a guest or two to be announced later. So make sure you tune in tomorrow. As we were saying, this 3-hour show makes 8 continuous hours of live and local talk here on FM Talk 106.5. Very excited about that and the future and what that has in store. We're going to try to make the most of it. So hopefully you stick with us. Let's get into some national politics, presidential debates. It's about that time we start getting into the presidential cycle. You'll have the two conventions, but the two conventions, they are going to be, it looks to me, very scaled down, are in some cases virtual. The Jacksonville component now canceled. That was going to be the big celebration for Republicans. It's going to be a very scaled down version in Charlotte. That whatever the Democrats do in Milwaukee to nominate Joe Biden, the presumptive nominee right now, traditionally presidential cycles, guys, you get to the conventions, and that's kind of the springboard into the election season. These campaigns use that as a momentum builder heading into election day. Not going to have that. Well, then what's that going to look like? When do we know? And this has been a very strange election cycle, even going back to the Democratic race for the nomination. Go back to 2019 before COVID or any of this was going on. And it was kind of a page two story. It wasn't front page. Why? Well, there was impeachment going on. And everything was dominated by impeachment. And then maybe on MSNBC at 3 a.m, you would have a Democratic debate, and that would get the attention of the media. But it hasn't been, first and foremost. It has been kind of a side story. And then Joe Biden struggles in Iowa. Joe Biden struggles in New Hampshire. And then we get to South Carolina, and Joe Biden wins, and then it just seems like the Red Sea, the parting of the Red Sea, and the pathway opened up for Joe Biden. He's a presumptive nominee, and now here we are. Here we are is the question, though. What's a Joe Biden-Donald Trump matchup going to look like? It's going to be different from Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. I don't think that the negatives for Joe Biden, while there may be some negatives for Biden, they're not where they are for Hillary Clinton. And it won't be just worse and worser when you go to vote. But there are some questions about Joe Biden's competency. And no one knows really, there's all kinds of speculation about that. But today in the New York Times, and you're starting to see this a lot more, an op-ed today about from Elizabeth Drew, let's scrap the presidential debates. The debates in presidential politics, they're not like state politics at all. You kind of have to do them. And I think if they try to do this, obviously this seems to be an effort to protect Joe Biden. I don't know what else it could be. Are either that, or are they afraid that Donald Trump will do so well and it won't even be a contest in November despite everything that's going on. But they want to do away with the presidential debates on the left. And I would have to just assume they don't think Joe Biden's up for the task. He's not going to perform that well. He stumbles. He misspeaks all the time. There's gaffes. And this isn't just Joe Biden of 2020. This is Joe Biden of 1986. This has been happening for a while. So if you get them side by side, Donald Trump stands to gain. That is the fear for Democrats. But guys, if they cancel the debates, people are going to be like, what are they hiding? This isn't like Alabama. So, KIV avoided debates. Then we had the big Senate issue. Why won't, you know, why won't Tommy Tuberville debate, or why won't Jeff Sessions debate? You know, that was already kind of, it seemed like a lot of the politics were kind of baked in. But at the, where presidential elections are decided is really at the margins. It's really at the margins of seven or eight states, the purple states, as they say. Now, I think without a debate, it's going to raise some red flags. People are going to kind of wonder what's going on. And then can Joe Biden, if there are no debates, does he have that bully pulpit? Does he? Will people tune in? Because with presidential debates, everybody watches all at once. All, you know, all the networks carry them. Everybody has it on. And you watch these debates. And then you kind of know who the actors are. The public gets its first taste of, you know, that side-by-side comparison. And then, you know, we talk about it. Without that, you don't have that, the compare and contrast. That could hurt Biden, I think. Not only because, well, he's not doing a debate because there's something wrong there, but he doesn't get the exposure. You need that exposure. Without the conventions, without the early primary states really being in the news because we're talking about the impeachment of Trump early in 2020 and late 2019, are people as familiar with Joe Biden as we think? I mean, he was a United States vice president, but the vice president of the United States, how wholesale is that? And when it comes to presidential elections where you have very high voter participation, who is going, where people go in and they vote based on name ID, and that exists? It could hurt Joe Biden. But this move to scrap presidential debates seems, I think that's a tell, guys. I think the Democrats are really worried that this isn't going to be decided. This presidential race isn't going to be decided on anything that has to do with, you know, what's your policy on taxes, or, you know, whatever the hot button issue of the day is, even handling coronavirus. We are a very superficial society, and it's going to be looks, it's going to be appearances, and we don't know how Donald Trump next to Joe Biden is going to play out. There's a fear there. That's a vulnerability. Republicans need to exploit that vulnerability. You want to win in 2020? Why is Joe Biden hiding? Let's get these guys next to each other. Go on the offensive. The trick to Donald Trump has always been, if you look at his presidential campaign, it's an insurgency. It's the silent majority. And you got the other side on defense. Right now, the other side, the Democrats, are playing offense. And they're playing it really well. I mean, those approval ratings, they don't lie. Those numbers in some of those swing states, but, they're not good. But things are starting to tighten. And this isn't going to, this gap, this gulf between the two candidates isn't going to last forever. Because they always, historically, things start to tighten. So you don't get too down right now based on whatever the polling is. And keep in mind, the way this polling data is being presented to the American public, it's a little absurd. They will give you results from adults or registered voters. Really, you got to look at the likely voters. And national polls, they're good for trends. It's very important to watch those trends. You don't want to be in a bad direction in national polls. But we don't decide our president based on the popular vote. So these national polls, they may oversample Los Angeles, New York, wherever. What's going to happen when you go after those metropolises? Well, it's going to lean blue. It's going to lean Democrat. That's... My problem with national polls is the methodology. And the only reason you pay real close attention to them, don't look at the averages. You can't average a bunch of polls that were collected by different means and think that's a true depiction of what really where we are as a country. But just watch the trends of the polls. You know, what was this poll a week ago? What was it 2 weeks ago or a month ago or, you know, whatever? And which way that is going gives you an idea of which way the wind is blowing. That's what you want to know. Is this working? Is this resonating? Is that gap starting to tighten? I think the gap tightens. But I think if Joe Biden doesn't debate, if Joe Biden doesn't show up on that debate stage, and they try to tinker with what we have done for the last 50 years with presidential debates on television, then they're going to hurt their candidate. But there's a push. Watch these. There's going to be a bunch of these op-eds show up over and over again saying maybe you don't want put Joe Biden up there on the stage with Donald Trump because it elevates him to the same level, and we don't need that. He is less than a president. He's not my president. Yada, yada, yada. And they think they can keep doing that, and that's a winning strategy. It's a losing strategy. I'm telling you, it's a losing strategy. It only satisfies people in certain places in the country. As I said, 7 to 8 states, it's decided on a very thin margin. And that's where people might say, I don't know about this. I'm going to, you know, things are so bad, I think people are going to be actively participating in the civic process. Because so much federal government, it touches everything we do in our lives right now. So you may have an uptick in participation, but it's not going to do a service if the left continues on this path. I just think it's a losing message. And I know, you know, I'm preaching to the choir here for a lot of us that, yeah, we want to see a presidential debate. We want to see debates in general, but the idea that you're going to change your mind based on the debate itself is one thing, but just not showing up, it seems to say, hey, what are we hiding here? And it's going to fuel that narrative that there's something going on with the former vice president, his mental capacity, all these stories you're hearing, that there's something going on there. If he doesn't debate, they're going to have to get him on that debate stage side by side with the president, whether the New York Times and the op-ed writers at the New York Times like it or not. I don't see the other way possible, you know, way forward. But if they try to do that, it's going to hurt them, and maybe that's good for some of us. All right, guys, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back. This is the Jeff Porch Show at FM Talk 106.5.
Hello, West Virginia coal miner. Let me thank you for your time. You work a 40-hour week for a living. Just to send it on down the line. This is for the one who drives the big rig.
Yeah, you know, no call. And welcome back to the Jeff Porch Show at FM Talk 106.5, this debut of the Jeff Porch Show. Going to be a fun journey. Hopefully you'll stay with us. Very appreciative of the listeners and of Sean Sullivan, who is chomping on a Whopper or something right now. As this kind of starts to unfold. But thank you for being with us. Joining us now in studio, good friend of mine. We go way back many, many years. Now he is in the legislature. State Representative Matt Simpson is with us. Representative, how are you?
I'm good. Glad to be here. I've been a guest on your show a number of times from when you were in Huntsville, and I'm sure the people in Huntsville are like, what is a state representative from Daphne doing on the radio in Huntsville? So it's glad to have you local and in the area.
Well, and then they would say that with a lot of, like, why is there a state representative from Dothan on or whatever? It just was that kind of show, but well, we're going to try to continue in that vein. But you were always gracious to come on and talk about stuff. I guess for this listening audience, so we haven't talked about this, but we'll hit it again, the prisons, that DOJ report that came out week before, or I guess it was week before last, and it highlighted some of just the stuff that seems like you put it, lack of institutional control. When you talk about the NCAA, we know that is those of us in Alabama are familiar with the NCAA. When you hear that, the bad things are coming. But that's what it seemed like to me, that, you know, the while we know that the Department of Justice is really looking down at Alabama and the Department of Corrections, there's these unresolved issues going on with the staffing and with the conditions and whatnot.
You're right. That report showed absolute just lack of institutional control. I've used that phrase, and I was to Alabama when Dubose was the coach, so I'm well aware of that phrase. You know, when you have, like in Alabama, they had rogue boosters operating in a certain manner, and they firm them, and they say, are these something that is looked down upon by the institution, or is this something that's allowed? And you look at what's happened with these prison guards, and that report is 28 pages, and in that report is multiple instances, not just of the actions, but of what occurred following the actions of those prison guards. You know, they're in a rough environment, number one. They're underpaid. They're understaffed. They're in a stressful situation where they're outnumbered tremendously by the inmates, so they're kind of trying to help the best they can. But the situation that the DOJ brought up, and the problem was, the Alabama Department of Corrections was investigating themselves. They weren't turning over the results of their investigation over the DAs or any local authorities. They were able to sweep some instances under the rug, and the DOJ found that there was instances and there was a culture. And this was the problem. It was a culture of allowing these excessive force uses to be unreported or underreported and nothing done on them. And that's a problem within DOJ. If you're going to say, hey, I'm going to take this all on our own, I'm going to investigate this ourselves, we're going to have our own unit set up, and we're going to check and make sure that we're doing the right thing. Well, the problem is, if you don't have those outside eyes looking in, if you don't have some other force that can look in and say, hey, this is a problem, when everything hits the fan, you're going to have to answer for that on your own. And that's the problem. And that's the answer, the issue with the leadership that they have there. They set up that culture to where it did not have to be reported, where these officers could get away with doing these things, where this culture of allowing officers to have this excessive force without reporting, without suspending them, even if they were disciplined, minimal suspensions. You know, it's one of those things of you've gotten so far away from what the normal and acceptance would be for how you should go, how you should run things. It's time to put new eyes on this. It's time to put some new ears to kind of say, hey, this is not acceptable anymore. We're not going to allow this to happen in on my watch. And I think new leadership in the Department of Corrections is needed.
So, yeah, Jeff Dunn, the commissioner of the Alabama Department of Corrections, you think it's time for him to go?
Yeah, he was appointed in 2015. He's been given a rough shot. You know, it's a difficult situation for the prisons in Alabama. I will tell you that it is a rough hand to be dealt with what he's got. We need to fund the prisons. We need to build more prisons. We need to pay for more staff. There's a lot that we need to do to make the prisons better. But that's the job you took. That's the job you accepted. Everything in this report happened on your watch. And you have to answer for what happened on your watch. And he has not answered for what happened on his watch. My question is, what does a bad job look like? You know, if you're saying
this was good, what is, you know, point B on the continuum?
Right.
You know, is that well, why, you know, I don't even know where to start with that. I guess it could be you could have prison riots and things like that. It could deteriorate in such a direction. But this, to me, the Eighth Amendment stuff and just the highlighting of that is not a good light for Alabama.
And on top of that, Jeff, we had a report come out in April of 2019, and the most of that report talked about inmate-on-inmate violence, you know, the treatment of the inmates within, you know, their mental health safety, their safety from other things like that. That report comes out in April of 2019. This report comes out in July of 2020, where it's just about officer excessive force, officer on inmate violence. And that is all about the July report. July 2020 report is all about officer inmate violence. The problem is, you have this report that comes out in April. You know the DOJ is looking at you. You know the spotlight's on. You know the light is being shined, and they're coming around looking at you. A lot of these instances happened after April of 2019 with the officer involved. So if you know DOJ's there,
why aren't you straightening up your act and doing better? Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
How can this happen after the investigation's there? How do you not have your people sit around and say, "Look, we got to do something. We can't continue to do this." Some of the stuff that happened, Jeff, they had an officer who beat a guy. And was, as he was beating him, was sitting there telling him, "I am the reaper of death, and you will say my name." And nurses are sitting there saying, "We're trying to get this guy to stop." There are reports of nurses saying, "These guys come in, we've seen the officer hit him, we've seen the force being used, and there's no reports of physical force being used on this." It's not acceptable. We can't allow it. I am as law and order and as pro-law enforcement as you possibly can be. I've got 12 years as a prosecutor as my career. This is what I believe in. I what are your stance in prisons? I believe we should have more of them. But I believe that when we do send somebody off to prison, they are not to be treated as less than individuals. You know, they have the right to be safe in where they are, to the extent of not to be handcuffed and beaten, not to be punched in the face because you stick your tongue out at an officer and nothing happens. It's one of those things of you have to rehabilitate these guys and try to get them out so you don't have the recidivism. 95% of everybody that walks into a prison doors gets out. Not everybody's there for life or life without possibility of parole or for the death sentence. So if you just go there and you treat them in this manner and you allow them to be treated by other inmates in this manner, you allow them to be treated by officers in this manner, what do you expect when people get out of prison? How do you expect them to act? We've lost our way in the Alabama Department of Corrections and the prison system with where we need to go. Let's get back on track. Let's go the direction we need to go in.
How close do you think we are really from a receivership or some kind of intervention from the federal government?
You know, I hope not close. You know, they've worked really hard. I talked with Attorney General Steve Marshall, and he's talked about some of the success they've done. When you bring up Tutwiler, you know, right. The Department of Justice came in and said, you have to work on these women's prisons, you have to work on this. And now Tutwiler has transformed and become one of the model prisons for women prisoners that you have. We've shown an effort to be willing to work with the DOJ and say, hey, listen, we'll listen to you. We'll listen to some of your concerns. What can we do to make this better? How can we work to make this better? I think that's a big deal to show them, come with us and work with us. I think if we also want to send the message of we hear you, we get your message, we've got to give them something too and say, hey, we no longer have that person that was in charge when all this happened. That person is no longer in charge, and we're looking at it with fresh eyes.
It shows you're making some reform and some measures, because it seems to me all 2018 talked about, but we couldn't do it because that was an election year. Okay, fair enough. 2019 rolls around. Well, we don't have time in this general session. We'll call a special session later in the year, and that never happens. Sean and I were sitting there. Del Marsh, the Senate pro tem, says, "Hey, yeah, we're going to do a special session in the fall of 2019." Never happens. So we're waiting on sentencing commissions and all these blue ribbon panels to give us stuff. It just seems like always this is getting put off, and then COVID-19. At some point, you can only kick that can down the road so far before. Something's going to have to happen, or it's that worst case scenario, right?
That's the fear. That is the concern when they come in with this conservatorship or consent decree or whatever, how it comes through. You know, we budgeted in 2019, in the 2019 budget, we budgeted a substantial increase to the Department of Corrections for them to hire more officers, to hire more guards. They've used some of that money. They haven't used all that money. And that's a problem. That's a point of contention with the legislature. It's like, hey, if we're going to budget you for $40 million, how about you spend that $40 million on an increase in stuff rather than just hold it and sit there? You know, the governor has stressed, and she's made a point. In 2017, they tried to push this prison to come through the legislature. The legislative session, you know, it got off track when people start fighting about where are the prisons going to go.
Right, because it's an economic engine for some of these local areas.
Completely. And you have some areas that are going to fight tooth and nail to make sure that if they have a prison, they keep that prison, or other areas are going to fight to try to get a prison. That side of the politics side of it gets ugly and it gets messy, and that can cause a delay. I don't like that the governor is going forward and said, I'm going to do this on my way. I'm going to do it. I'm not going to tell you guys about it. You'll find out about it when we tell everybody else in the press. That's how you'll find out about it as a legislature. I'm not a fan of that method. I'd like prefer to work to somebody together where we can come together and work and collaborate on issues together and not just have one person make these decisions. But I see her point. It's tough. Right. It's tough to make that argument and say, no, let's work together, when she can turn around and say, we just worked together in 2017 and it didn't work. We do have a new legislature since 2017. We have not worked on it since this legislature came in. We had a turnover of about a third of new members that have come in 2018. So why not let's try and see what we can come up with.
Well, Matt, the thing that always gets me, whenever this topic comes up, and people on the left will say, well, Republicans are shy about, you know, prisons. It's not part of their orthodoxy. It's not part of, you know, their ideology, that the spending money on prisons is not where, you know, that's not a traditional Republican thing. And that's why we never address it. But I would argue that most of us, especially at a time like this when law and order seems to be what the Republican electorate is yearning for, that prisons is a component of that, and instinctively they would recognize, well, you want, like you were saying, I'm for more prisons. That is a component of law and order. And I don't know, this whole idea that it's just a Republican problem is mythology.
I agree with you. There's no way that public safety is not a Republican principle. You know, public safety and infrastructure, that's two of the things we pride ourselves on as Republicans, to come in and say, this is what we're going to focus on. Part of public safety is to make sure that if someone commits a crime and they need to be taken out of society for a little while, we have a place to put them. We have a place to say, we're not just going to leave you on the streets. We're not going to let you continue to commit crimes and continue to not be punished for it. We're just going to put you on, I guess, double secret probation this time, and you really don't want to mess up this time, even if it's your third, fourth, or fifth felony. We're not going to send you away because we don't have a place to send you. The concern is what happens when the prisons come in and we haven't addressed it. We haven't paid the money we need to pay. We haven't gotten the guards we need to pay. We don't have the structures we need. What happens when they come in and they say, okay, great, now all these people are going to walk on their own? You have, let's say you have 12,000 beds, you can only keep 12,000 inmates. Everybody else, you got to go. Anything 12,001 has to go.
Right.
And there's a lot of people. That's a problem. That's something we need to address. It's happened in California. This isn't something that's never happened before. This is something that has been done by the federal government before. California has been shook by what happened. You know, they're still recovering from the efforts that made when they released a handful. You know, not a handful, just everybody. They just said, here, this group, you're going to go home. And The criminal system.
They had no real answer for that, to put people out on the streets and not have, you know, a place to go in some cases, or, you know, a job or any of that. That creates bigger societal problems, and that would be my concern, that you look at the California experience. You don't want that happening in Alabama.
You're exactly right, and we need to do what we can to make sure. If you look at the Department of Justice reports, the two reports that I referenced, the April 2019 report and the July 2020 report, not one of those reports mentions sentencing reform. Not one. It's not mentioned. It's not discussed. It's not talked about. It's talked about how do you treat the prisoners? How do you maintain where the prisoners are located? How do you keep they're not in crumbling facilities? How do you make sure, how do you work on their mental health? How do you help them? You know, and part of that is coming in and saying, okay, look, we're going to teach you a trade. When you get out of prison, you're going to have a marketable skill that you can do to try to make yourself a productive member of society. There's efforts being made within the legislature to try to get those bills passed, try to get funding for those programs, to try to help and make sure that, look, okay, you messed up. It doesn't mean you have to stay in that cycle for your entire life. You can get out, you can come in, and you can learn something. We've got people down here, we're begging to try to find the qualified jobs. You know, we've got so many jobs down here that people aren't coming down here. Companies don't come to Mobile and Baldwin County because they can't find the workforce.
It's the workforce that doesn't have the skills you need to fill some of those jobs, and that hurts your economic development.
Exactly. So if we can come up and say, hey, you know what? We can make a welder. We can make somebody here. We can get somebody out of prison to come in and give you an opportunity. That inmate say, you know what? You have a chance. You have a shot. Once you get out, you have a chance to do something better with yourself, and that's something we need to focus on.
All right, well, we're going to take a quick break here. We'll be right back with State Representative Matt Simpson. This is the Jeff Porch Show on FM Talk 106.5.
They begin to run it on down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico. We look down a river and we see the British come, and there must have been 100 of them beating on the drum. They stepped so high and they made the bugles ring. We stood beside our cotton bales.
Hear Richard Best picking on that red guitar. So gather round, now gather round, chill and be down. We're just getting down, chill and get loud.
And welcome back to the Jeff Porch Show on FM Talk 106.5. This debut of the Jeff Porch Show, I've made it to the final segment. It's kind of like the home stretch. Somehow, I have not fallen completely on my face. Just a few maybe brushes with falling on my face. But happy to be here. Happy that you're listening. We're going to do more. This is kind of the show. Once we work out the kinks, this will be what you get on a daily basis between 9 a.m. and noon. Looking very forward to it. Very honored to be to have you as listeners. And thanks to Sean Sullivan for making me, giving me this opportunity to talk to this audience. Still with us, by the way, State Representative Matt Simpson. Representative Simpson, the schools, you know, that's the new, I guess, the new hot button right now. Should schools start up? Is it safe to do schooling? Or is this virtual schooling even is it even going to work?
You know, I cannot take my hat off enough and commend Superintendent Eddie Tyler for the job he's done on Baldwin County Schools. What they've done and what they've said, they've notified the public and given all the information out there and said, look, if you want your kid to come to school, schools will be available and this is how we're going to do it. If you do not want your kid to come to school, you have the opportunity for distance learning, for virtual school, and this is how you go about that track. And you let the parents make the decision. You know, my kids love being home, and they're, you know, I consider them smart kids. Our kids struggled in the fourth quarter last year. You know, I've got a daughter that's going into second grade. The perception is I can't get her to learn on a computer screen. She's not to that level yet where she can watch a virtual and keep her attention and keep her focus on what goes on there. And There is no right answer to this question. I will tell you, every family needs to do what's best for their own family. Make your own choice, make your own decisions, and say, you know what, for my family, it's best if we do distance learning. And that's fine. That is great. That is your option, and that is your choice that the Baldwin County Schools have allowed you to do. But if you're like me and you're like, we have found out, my wife and I have found out, we are not homeschool parents, and we just can't do it. That is not a gift that we've
been
given.
You don't have the means to hire a tutor or a teacher to come in. I mean, it seems like if this is around to stay, if this is the new normal for a while with COVID-19, my worry is this is going to turn into like a feudal system where the haves can hire teachers and have their own education system, and then the have-nots, well, they're doing this thing on a computer screen that may or may not work, but they're not getting the most bang for their buck. I mean, there will be some real societal implications here unless we could figure out a workaround or a fix to this.
I agree with you. You know, I understand Baldwin and Mobile are different. I am blessed that my district covers both Baldwin and Mobile County. I understand the school system in Mobile made a different decision, and that's the decision that their superintendent made. I trust that they've done the best with the information that they've had to try to make the best decisions they've had. However, the appearance of a Mobile County school system to say, we're going to push back our start date to September the 1st, and we're going to go 9 weeks, and 9 weeks we'll make the decision on what we're going to do from there. Well, 9 weeks from September the 1st is presidential election day. And even if you – I'm not saying conspiracy theories in here. I'm not throwing that stuff around. But I'm saying just the appearance of saying
right. Things
may be better on election day, so we're going to figure out what can happen and schools will come back. You've got to have some type of mind to be able to say, you know what, we're not going to say let's just wait till after the presidential election to come back to school. Somebody has to be there on the inside to say this looks bad. Because there's the conspiracy theories that you go around, you know, where you hear about all these things that go on. It's you don't want to feed that trolling mechanism where somebody can say, oh, look what they did. The schools just said it'll be what happens after presidential election day. So it's just one of the things that the public perception is not great on that.
And real quick, we just got a minute or two here left. You were in Trustville for an ALGOP meeting. What is the vibe among Republicans in Alabama when you're talking to them up there about the presidential election?
You know, everybody's on board. This is a super important election for our lifetime as we come in to make sure that we protect not only the president, the White House. We need to make sure that we have the Senate. We need to get, you know, everybody rallied around hopefully future Senator Tuberville as he came in and spoke to us. Those numbers are important as we're on that fine line of 50, 51, 52. How far are we going to have? Is it going to go Republican? Is it going to go Democrat? The future of the country is at stake with what we're looking at. You have some Supreme Court justices that are going out. So it's not just a, yes, we support the president. It's a, we support down ballot races as well.
Hey, we got to leave it there. Matt Simpson, thank you. This has been the Jeff Ford Show on FM Talk 106.5.